Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
This episode is brought to you by Nyman Ranch. I'm Paul Willis, a fifth-generation farmer and co-founder of Nyman Ranch Pork Company. Learn more about us at NymanRanch.com.
This week on Meat and Three, we're diving straight no chaser into the delicious crossover of the food and jazz worlds.
And I think that sense of nostalgia is what makes it hard to do New Orleans food well, because people just have these memories of these dishes. Certainly people from New Orleans, like, you're never going to make, you know, a gumbo as good as their mother or grandmother made, right?
Comfort food, you got to get your hands dirty, and the jazz is musicians. It's like it all goes together very well, you know?
Check out Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello, I'm Diane Stemple on Heritage Radio Network for Cutting the Curd. Today, I want to welcome Mark Kurlansky, writer of Milk, a 10,000-year food fractus. I read your cod book, I think, when it came out long ago, and I read it around that time, and I was fascinated by its perspective. So I was very eager to read and discuss Milk with you, but didn't realize how much more complicated it would be. And it's a long, long story.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, cod is basically a 1,000-year history, and this is like 10,000.
Whoa! Well, the size of the book was one thing. That was my first clue.
Right.
But then it was like, oh, wow, this is complicated.
Yeah, well, it is. And, you know, I mean, people have been fighting over it forever. And it's not really very surprising if you think about what it is.
Uh-huh. You know? Were you surprised? Now, how did you come to write the book Milk?
Oh, well, a magazine called Modern Farmer.
Yes.
Asked me to write something about milk. Mm-hmm. And they were very unspecific about what they wanted me to write.
Uh-huh. It's a great magazine.
Yes, it is. And so I went checking around in dairies in the Hudson Valley and places close to New York.
Mm-hmm.
And I very quickly discovered that dairy farmers who live on a very narrow margin, mm-hmm, are dealing with a ton of different controversies. And these controversies, mm-hmm, can be a problem, but they're also an opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And that this is the reality that dairy farming lives in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so for example, if the idea of grass-fed cows is popular, but if you don't live in a place that has grass all year round, that becomes complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And it produces less milk per cow. And the economic formula that all dairy farmers work on is how much milk per cow you can get.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, you have something special about your milk that you can charge more for, because the government recommended price, which everyone is stuck for, is too low.
Mm-hmm.
So farmers are interested in doing something special so that they can get a price above that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I quickly came to understand what a complicated business this is.
Mm-hmm. So that got you interested?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Now, your book, Salt and Cod, seem much more similar to each other as books than milk. Is that, would you say that's true?
You know, I don't know. I don't I don't think about it. I don't think in that way. I actually, when I finish a book, I very quickly move on.
Okay.
And I tend not to look back.
Okay.
So I don't know. You may be right about that. I just never thought about it.
Okay. Now, what was your game plan initially for this book, and did it change as you researched?
Well, my game plan was, I mean, to start with the ancients and work up to the present and show how these controversies keep being dealt with. And and I don't know that I had any big surprises. I think I didn't realize at first how few people actually drank milk until modern times.
That's interesting.
Because it's dangerous, you know.
Yes.
I mean, less dangerous with pasteurization, but and also with
refrigeration.
And refrigeration and modern technology for preserving raw milk.
Yeah.
But you know, up until the 20th century, it was very dangerous, and by and large, the only people who drank milk were people who lived on farms, because even though they didn't know what bacteria was and didn't really understand what the source of the danger was, it was understood that milk had to be really fresh to be safe.
Mm-hmm.
So if you lived on a farm, you know, you go back to old recipes that use milk, and they actually say, you know, take the bucket, go to the barn, because that's the only safe milk.
Right. Right. Now, how did you decide which recipes to include in the book? And there are many, I think, historical recipes. Are there not?
Yeah, mostly. Mostly. I love recipes. I love historical recipes. I love them as artifacts that tell us about history and past times. And you know, they used to be much more interesting the way they were written. Until people like Fanny Farmer came along and tried to make recipes a scientific formula. They used to be much more expressive and give the cook much more leeway in how they did things. And in the process, you know, you learned a lot about a society by looking at these old recipes.
Were there any recipes in Cod? I don't recall.
Oh, yeah, quite a few.
Oh, okay.
Quite a few.
I guess I don't eat that much cod.
Oh, well, what can I say?
So I didn't remember them.
Yes, I have a lot of recipes in many of my books.
Okay.
Because I just
You
I
like
love
recipes.
Yeah.
Okay. So there's so many things that I did not know about milk and cheese, and butter was considered filthy.
Well, yeah. I mean, there were all of these. There were all of these prejudices. You know, the Romans were very contemptuous. The Romans went to Europe and discovered that people were eating, using milk and butter and dairy products much more than they did. And of course, in their society, most of the stuff was just used by farmers, except you know, cheese and. Yogurt. And so what often happens with societies is that people tend to be contemptuous of things that farmers do, because farmers mm-hmm. are supposed to be backwards, even though they actually know more than we do, but somehow.
Right.
You know, the Romans reported that all these people in Europe were really backwards. They were
right.
using lots of butter and drinking mm-hmm. milk and all these backwards things that in, you know, in Italy only farmers were doing.
Mm-hmm. In, like, one phrase is the barbaric use of butter by the Irish.
Yes, well, you know.
That seems crazy to me. I love butter.
It's the fate of the Irish that they always do wonderful things and get called barbarians for it.
I guess so. It's, I mean, I love butter.
Why wouldn't you?
Right. Now, and also cheese heads was an insult for Dutch people at one time?
Yes. Yeah, because they ate so much cheese. They were, this was a sign of backwardsness. And,
uh-huh.
and until, you know, until Holland became the most successful country in Europe, you know, with the most developed economy and everything. And then people started thinking, oh, maybe there's something to eating cheese.
Right, right, right.
Cheeseheads today, of course, are supporters of the Wisconsin teams.
Right, right. Now, no dairy was allowed on holy days? I didn't know that. I mean, I knew you couldn't eat meat on holy days.
Well, yeah, I mean, this was a huge thing. It's why whaling was popular. And I mean, there used to be about half of the days of the year were considered holy days, and,
mm-hmm.
and food was divided into warm food and cold food,
mm-hmm.
Which it still pretty much is in China. It's a concept that Europeans have dropped, but Asians have kept.
But not hot temperature versus cold temperature.
It doesn't have to do with temperature, no.
Right,
it has to do with some... metaphysical kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
What are hot
mm-hmm.
foods and what
mm-hmm.
are cold foods? And hot foods cannot be eaten on holy days because, as everybody knows, hot foods lead to sex.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, so, you know, if you have fish for dinner, you'll behave yourself, but if you have a steak, look out.
Oh, okay. Okay,
That was the thinking. And milk... milk was considered a hot food. It was actually considered white blood because it was this liquid that came from bodies. And,
right. Yes, white blood. That's a totally foreign concept to me.
Yeah, so half the days of the year you couldn't use milk. And that's actually the origin of almond milk.
Oh, interesting.
You'll see in medieval recipes they will say, you know, take a cup of milk or almond milk, meaning if it's a holy day, use almond milk.
Oh, okay. Okay. So almond milk was around long ago?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, in the Middle Ages, at least.
Huh. Now, how did milk get into the innards of butchered animals to quickly make cheese? What's your impression of how that happened?
I'm sorry, I didn't follow that.
How did milk get into the innards of butchered animals to quickly make cheese?
You mean how did butchered animals get into milk?
No. How did it get the milk get into the butchered animals so that it made cheese? The butchered animals, the stomach, the fourth stomach.
Yes. You mean you're talking about the
how did cheese begin?
How did cheese begin? Well, we can only sort of guess at that.
Mm-hmm. What's your opinion?
Well, I don't. You know, there's always these stories about how, you know, they carried milk in a bladder or a stomach or something, and you know, at the end of the horse ride, oh, look at that, it's cheese.
Mm-hmm.
But there's too many stories like that to believe them all. That's also the origin of yogurt and all sorts of things.
Okay.
So I'm...
You don't buy it.
I don't buy it. they somehow figured out that you had to make curd to make cheese.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't, by the way, have to make curd from animals. You can make it from grapes or a number of other things, which is, you know, why you can have kosher cheese.
Right. Now, there's a long story of ice cream in your book.
Yeah.
What are the highlights for you of the ice cream story?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's just terrible to imagine a world without ice cream. <You know?
laughs> That's true. That's true.
I kind of love these vendors in American cities that, you know, have these little glass cups and you pay a little bit of money and you get this cup. Completely unhygienic, you know. It's like my mother never would have gone for this. But you get a little glass dish with some ice cream in it and you eat it and you hand back the glass dish and they use it again. But, you know, the nice thing about the history of ice cream is it's very clear that wherever ice cream was introduced, people just loved it.
Uh-huh. Yes, that's true. Yeah. And it's popped up in many places.
Yeah, yeah. And many variations on it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Indians have, in India, they have their own variation on ice cream, which is sold on the street.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, ice cream is much older than freezers.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So for a long time, it was something you couldn't have at home.
Right, right. You had to go to the ice place.
Right. Right. There's an ice cream recipe in the book that I particularly like for a coffee ice cream. It's Italian, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Artusi Pellegrini. It's wonderful kind of espresso ice cream recipe.
Mm.
There's a number of ice cream recipes in there.
Yes, I noticed.
They're all great.
Have you made them all? Do you make them?
Now, the funny thing is, do I make the recipes?
Yes.
No, I don't, because I'm not really that interested in whether they're good recipes or not. I'm just interested in their historic value. So it depends on my subject. Actually, you asked about cod. Cod has lots of recipes, but many of them are horrible.
Oh.
But they're historically interesting.
Okay.
Now, when I did my Bass book, all of those recipes were good.
Mm-hmm.
And when I did the Milk book, there were just so many recipes to choose from that I thought, mm-hmm. why not just pick good ones?
Right.
So all those recipes are good.
Oh, okay, good. But did you make them?
I made a few of them.
Okay.
I made a few of them.
Do you
have
other people make them for you?
No, I don't really. I don't test the recipe. If it's a, you know, if it's an interesting source and an interesting recipe and it's written in an interesting way, I'm happy. you're on your own whether you like it or not.
Okay. Okay, it's time for a break. We'll be right back in a few minutes with Mark Kurlansky discussing his book, Milk.
My name is Paul Willis. I'm a fifth-generation hog farmer, and I owned and operated the Willis Free Range Pig Farm for over 41 years. I've dedicated my life to revitalizing sustainable hog farming methods in the Midwest and moving farms away from the common industrial practices. In 1998, I established the Nyman Ranch Pork Company. I'm proud to say Nyman Ranch has since grown into a network of over 740 independent family farmers and ranchers today. At Nyman Ranch, our animals are raised with care. We believe that the quality of an animal's life impacts the quality of the meat. Our high standards were developed with the help of animal welfare expert Dr. Temple Grandin and are among the strictest in the industry. All of our animals live outdoors or in deeply bedded pens, and they're never given antibiotics or added hormones ever, and are only fed a high-quality 100% vegetarian diet. Whether they're raising hogs, cattle, or lamb, Nyman Ranch farmers and ranchers share our commitment to traditional farming, raising livestock in the way our parents and grandparents did, and supporting our rural communities. We share a common belief that humane and sustainable methods produce the best possible flavor. Learn more about our work at Nyman Ranch at NymanRanch.com.
Hi, it's Diane Stemple on Cutting the Curd on HeritageRadioNetwork.org, interviewing Mark Kurlansky about his lengthy and interesting book, Milk. Hi, Mark. We're back.
It's not that lengthy. We're not talking Tolstoy here.
Well, no. I think, I read lots of books about cheese, and it's a long book compared to cheese books.
Right, okay.
And compared to recipe books, which you don't have to read.
Right, right.
So anyway, for me it was long, and I learned a lot. I mean, I have lots of notes on all the things I learned. Like, I didn't realize Velveeta was named for velvet textured cheese. I never thought of it.
Also, it's not really cheese.
Well, yes. I mean, that's why I never thought about Velveeta. And then when I saw in your book, it's named after velvet.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was wild to me. And it was in 1918?
Yeah, right there.
It was invented. This is a fact I never knew. And I wanted to know.
Well, there was a big growth in industrialized cheese.
Yes.
In the first part of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
Because they had finally developed milking machines.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of amazed me. This is something that really surprised me.
Okay.
You know, in the Industrial Revolution in the 19th century,
mm-hmm.
They were coming up with steam-powered everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really surprised that they could not come up with a milking machine.
Mm-hmm.
It took quite a long time. But once they did,
mm-hmm.
what happened was, it used to be, there really weren't dairy farms as we think of them today, because, how many cows can you milk by hand?
Right.
So there were small farms. Yeah, you'd have a farm, and on the farm you'd have three or four cows.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with milking machines, you could have 50 cows or 100 cows. Today, mm-hmm. Thousands of cows.
Right.
And one of the really odd things to me about the whole history of dairy
mm-hmm.
is that most things in general are the production bears a direct relationship to demand.
Mm-hmm.
And it never seemed to with milk.
Huh.
It was always about producing as much milk as you possibly could. And once they got the milking machine, they could produce lots of milk without thinking about who wanted all this milk.
Mm-hmm. So then they had to come up with a plan for what to do with it.
Right. And then that's when they started coming up with a lot of industrial cheese.
Mm-hmm. And women who used to make cheese... No, they lost their jobs of making cheese on the farm.
This is a very funny thing. This is all the prejudices that people have.
Mm-hmm.
It was firmly believed that only women could make cheese.
Mm-hmm.
But then it was also firmly believed that only men could work in factories.
Okay.
So what do you do with a cheese factory?
You switch it to men.
Right.
Yeah, because so the women lost their cheesemaking jobs.
Right, but at first there was a tremendous skepticism about this industrial cheese just because it was being made by men. And cheese being made by men seems like a dubious enterprise.
Huh. Now, was it Wisconsin where they became the leading cheese-producing state?
Yes, yes, because of that industrialization.
Right.
And
right.
Huge milk production.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And now, what's next? So, I want to know, what are the most important ideas in this book? And have they changed at all since it was published in 2019, now that we're at the end of 2018, and now that we're at the end of 2019?
Not really anything in particular has changed. I mean, when you're talking about things that people argue about, you know, one argument rises and another argument falls, and then the old argument comes back in and stuff. So there are those sort of fluctuations, but. I mean, what's going on, which I wrote about in my book, is that small farms are dying.
Yes, yes.
And that process is certainly continuing.
Mm-hmm. And in the cheese industry or the artisanal cheese industry, we're very concerned about that because we like the small cheesemakers mostly.
Yeah, and, you know, it's kind of a curious thing, a good thing, that actually that business is really doing all right. I mean, there's a considerable demand for artisanal cheese. You would be better off being a small-scale cheesemaker than a small-scale milk producer.
Uh-huh. Yes, that's why a lot of people go into it, I think.
Right.
Yeah. Now, how do you think global warming is affecting the entire dairy industry?
Well, that is a
big question.
Very complicated question. you know, it might even have some benefits. it might make grass-fed cows more practical in some places than they were before.
Mm-hmm. Why is that?
Well, because if you're not having if you're having mild winters, you can graze the cows all year round.
Ah.
See, the thing that people kind of miss, because there's this mystique about grass-fed, and everybody wants grass-fed, and because of it, people will pay more for grass-fed. But actually, grass-feeding is the cheapest way to feed a cow.
Hmm.
As long as you have the grass growing.
Ah, because you don't have to buy it.
Right. Mm. The only problem is that some grains cause higher production of milk than grass.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Okay. Now, I noticed one thing you write about is the American welfare appraisal. You can use antibiotics when needed.
Yeah. You know, this is a very complicated thing also. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have talked to many farmers who reject organic, and they reject, you know, animal welfare certificates. They do because they think that it is cruel not to treat sick cows with medicine. So this is a complicated issue with strong feelings on all sides.
Mm-hmm.
There is also a problem that we seem to be getting exposed to too many antibiotics.
Right. And that's getting more and more press, it seems.
Yes,
like.
Yes. But you know, I always go back to Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring.
Mm-hmm.
And most people don't realize this, but Rachel Carson never called for the banning of DDT.
Hmm.
She said it was being overused and it being used badly, and we have to start using it carefully.
Hmm.
And I think that's true of a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
But the real solution, you know, if you just absolute banning creates problems.
Right.
But what you really want to do is find a rational way of using.
Right. But we don't trust people.
Well, for good reason.
I think we don't trust, you know, in industrial farms because they'll overuse everything. And we don't, you know, so we get a bad taste in our mouth.
Yeah, I mean, it's, to me, a lot of crazy stuff goes on, you
mm-hmm.
know.
Mm-hmm.
Like the whole argument about GMO foods.
Mm-hmm.
I think, and most farmers think, GMO foods are a great idea.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is, I mean, this is the craziest thing. So they develop these plants that are resistant to pesticides.
Mm-hmm.
Great. So now you don't have to use pesticides. Wrong. They use pesticides with the plants because the plants are pesticide resistant.
And that makes no sense.
It makes no sense. And these pesticides are absolute poison. Then people mm-hmm. go around saying, you know, the GMO food is poison. It's not the GMO food that's poison. It's the pesticides they use with it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Hmm. Now, I have one more question. I'd like to know how you picked the cheeses to feature in the raw craftsmanship chapter.
Ha. Well, probably largely personal prejudices.
Ah, okay.
If you name a cheese, I'll tell you why I picked it.
Okay, Gouda, Howda, whatever you call it.
Well, that's one where many years ago I used to cover Holland for the International Herald Tribune. And I was struck with the difference between industrial, and Holland's a very industrial country, but the Bornkasse, the farm cheese, was so different and so much better.
Mm, okay.
And so Gouda, you know, not only don't we know how to pronounce it, but we don't know what it is.
So you discovered Gouda way back.
Yes.
It was one of your first favorite cheeses.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, what about Roquefort?
Oh, Roquefort is definitely one of my favorite cheeses. This is a complete personal prejudice. I love Roquefort, and it's a great story. This strange little town on a mountain ridge with these caves.
Yes.
Where everything gets moldy, and
It's cheap.
Yeah, and I love the way the European Union went in and said, "Oh well, you can't age them on these wooden shelves anymore because it's not hygienic," and so they took them out and put in plastic shelves and discovered that it didn't taste right. Cheese wasn't any good when you aged it in plastic shelves.
So they had to put it back.
They had to put it back, except mm-hmm. for one guy who always refused to do it in the first place.
Now, what about your Basque selection, Oso Arati?
Yeah, well, these are all personal prejudices.
You're admitting it. It doesn't say that in the book.
I spend a lot of time in Basque country, and I drive around. I have certain farms that I go mm-hmm. to. There's a very distinct difference between the high mountain cheese and the low mountain cheese. And
okay.
I prefer the high mountain.
Is it drier? Is it what? How is it different?
It's more pungent.
Stronger.
Yeah.
Okay. And what about Greek feta? Is that one of your favorites, or was that
in? I like it fine, but it's one of my favorites. I just thought it was a good story.
Okay. And Icelandic skyr. I was interested in that. It's a fresh cheese, not a yogurt.
Right, although people probably don't realize that. They're starting to sell it in the U.S.
It doesn't
have any fat, so it's really good cheese. Mm-hmm. You know, really good food, and, mm-hmm. you know, people just eat it like zero-fat yogurt, but it's actually not yogurt.
But it tastes very similar.
It does. It does. And it's very good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it goes back to the Vikings.
And
everything in Iceland goes back to the Vikings.
Yeah. Okay. So I love that you included the story of Stilton versus Stitchleton because I know Joe Schneider.
Ah.
So that was like a great story to read in your book.
Yeah, that's, you know, it just shows how crazy things get.
I was surprised that he started it in 2004. That was the date in the book.
Yeah.
I didn't realize it was that old.
Oh, you thought it would be later?
Yeah. Anyway.
That's what he said.
I'm sure he told the truth. Anyway, so I want to thank you for coming on the show. It's been great to speak to you. Do you have any further comments to make on cheese or milk or...
Well, I would just say this, that, you know, everybody when they're, you know, getting on all the things about farmers and all the things they're doing wrong and stuff, should try to remember that farmers are remarkable people who work extremely hard, never take a single day off, and are absolutely dedicated to what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And this notion of farmers as evil people trying to poison us, you know, there may be a few of those, but that is really an exception.
Mm-hmm.
So I would like people to have some respect for farmers.
Now, I think my audience, the artisanal cheese lovers and makers, I think we know that.
Uh-huh.
You know, I think because we love to hang out with farmers.
They're remarkable people, you know. This was very enlightening to me because I'm more of an ocean guy,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm more used to fishermen. And I think fishermen are great, but I never thought much about farmers.
Okay.
I'm not like a landed agricultural kind of person. And I just was very moved. I mean, I went to dairy farms all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought these people were tremendous.
Oh, good. That's good to hear. Okay. Thank you, Mark Kurlansky, for coming on the show and talking about your book, Milk. And this is Diane Stemple on Cutting the Curd, and I'll talk to you later. Bye.
Cutting the Curd is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.